Summer temperatures have kicked in and vegetables are rapidly growing. With the heat and drying air come other problems to be aware of. First, insects that ride the wind are beginning to show up from the south. And then, how does the sudden heat and low humidity affect vegetable growth? Can vegetables grow too quickly? And which vegetables need an extra boost of nutrition to grow to their prime? Today on The Zesty Garden, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist Dan Drost will address your vegetable growing questions. And in our next installment of Take a Hike, David Wallace will tell us about a hike to see Utah's state flower, the sago lily. This particular hike is easy, accessible, and you can even bring the dog along. That's today on The Zesty Garden, but first, the news.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Utah Shakespeare Festival, presenting Cole Porter's Anything Goes, with seven other productions June through October 2013 in Cedar City. www.bard.org.
Hello, welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we would love to have your participation in the program. That's what it's all about. So call us with your questions or comments at 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email by going to The Zesty Garden. So it's zestygarden@gmail.com. You know, Dan, I almost said Access Utah again. So.
Well, we know we want to stay in that genre because it's been imprinted in your brain. But we're here to talk about gardening, and we're talking particularly about your vegetable garden today. So if there are problems that you're having, or if you're having successes, or if you've had a bumper crop of asparagus like we've had, or if your rhubarb is phenomenal and the wife makes you lovely rhubarb pies with some regularity, then we want to hear about it.
So zestygarden@gmail.com. So, okay, let's start with asparagus since you brought it up. I noticed my asparagus was smaller this year than the year before. So something happened over the winter that I should have been doing, like maybe in the fall or in the spring. I'm not sure what. So what causes asparagus to not have as big as spears?
Well, two things happen. One, you have to kind of know when the bud is being initiated that's going to develop into the spear next year. And that occurs during July and August. So what was July and August 2012 like that might have influenced what was happening in the spring of 2013 crop?
And it was hot.
If I remember right, yes, it was quite hot. It was quite dry. And if you, even though the plant may not have shown it, if you had a little bit of water stress during that bud initiation period, two things potentially can go on. One, you don't initiate as many buds, and that particularly is problematic if you have a young asparagus planting that you're just establishing, or the buds that do initiate during that time frame are just not going to divide adequately, so you have to think about cell division, and you get less cell division, and therefore you get smaller spear size, and once the bud size is fixed, which it is during that July-August period when that occurs, you can't change it very much in the following year, regardless of what the growing conditions are like.
So I need to be getting ready for that right now.
Well, you
just
need
making
to
sure it's going to get
you
irrigated.
Need to irrigate right now anyway, yeah. So, because we finished harvesting our asparagus beds for our research purposes last Saturday. You know, so that's about usually I say about the between the 1st and 15th of June is when you should stop harvesting asparagus. And that's kind of depends a little bit on what you see happening. If you've seen this kind of decrease in spear size that occurs naturally over the course of the harvest period, what the weather conditions are like and all those other types of things, that kind of dictates it. But more importantly, what we need is sufficient time after we finish harvesting to grow the tops of the fern, of the asparagus, which we call the fern. So a spear grows into fern, And that then feeds the root system and helps with next year's crop. So you need to have enough time to grow fern and then enough time for that fern to recharge the root system so that you get your crop for next year that's going to be as vigorous as it was this year.
Should I have on some kind of mulch?
Well, I don't know that the mulch can't hurt you. When we were doing some studies in some of our organic plots, we had these straw mulch treatments, and we found that the soil moisture content in the straw mulch treatments was always higher than in the other treatments where we either had tillage or where we had, you know, a flaming treatment to try and keep the weeds down because we were growing things organically and we were kind of looking at weed management. But we never really, they were higher, but were they, you know, significantly higher than these other treatments? Not necessarily, because our irrigation regime was set up in such a way that we were trying to meet the needs of the crop. And so our recommendation then for your home vegetable garden or for a commercial field is that about every third week, what you do is you put on a big application of irrigation.
So one really deep watering.
One
every
deep
3 weeks.
Watering, because the asparagus roots go down 3 feet or 4 feet into the soil, and you want to fill that whole soil profile. And so that then allows a plant to do what it's going to do, store plenty of energy. It's going to keep growing roots deeply into the soil. And you need to make sure that that stress doesn't occur during this July and August time period when the next set of buds are being initiated, which will be the spears and the fern that we harvest next year. So you may see slightly smaller fern this year as a result of, you know, maybe some stress from last year. And so my recommendation is get out and give that plant right now that first big irrigation event so that you fill that profile back up, because it's pretty warm and we want to grow big fern and we want to grow healthy fern that can feed the root system. And then about every third week or so, add another big shot of irrigation water so that, you know, somewhere around the middle of July, it'd be your, you know, early to mid-July be your next one, early to mid-August your next one, and then your final application would be of irrigation would be about early September, and then we kind of let the plant go to bed.
So I have several questions floating around in my mind. So you say that the roots get down into the soil quite a bit. So the crown that you end up planting, that's about spades depth into the
six
soil.
6 or 8 inches deep.
But you have finer roots that are growing down.
Well,
from
you
those.
Have large storage roots. You know, they're kind of there to store the energy, and then off of those large storage roots, you have these fine feeding roots, we call them, and they are responsible for picking up fertilizer and nutrients and absorbing the water. And water gets absorbed into the large root as well, but the surface area that relative to all these fine roots is very different. So basically the fine roots do most of the water uptake and most of the nutrient uptake.
So that's why you don't want to water more than once every 3 weeks, because if the roots are going down that far, you don't want to, A, rot the crown.
That's right.
And if you're putting enough soil in, or excuse me, enough water into the soil profile, it's going to
extract it throughout the whole profile. And you know, asparagus crowns are kind of sensitive to a disease called fusarium, and if we have a wet soil all the time, then it encourages the development of this fusarium rot that affects both the crown and where the roots are. And so one big irrigation filling the profile allows us to do that. The plant then slowly dries the soil out as it's absorbing the water that it needs, and then periodically we come back in and recharge the profile. And so we did quite a bit of research work on that here, and I've been involved in research work in California that's been looking at irrigation too, and that basically was our recommendation, that, you know, you don't need to irrigate every week. You certainly don't want to irrigate every time you irrigate some of our other vegetable crops, simply because we just then create problems for ourselves with the asparagus planting. And that's why when we talk about establishing a new asparagus planting in the vegetable garden, that you establish it in a place where you can kind of put it aside so that you can do the right things for it rather than put it in and amongst everything else, where you're kind of forced to irrigate it more often than you really need to. And so the plant kind of accommodates itself to whatever conditions we put it into. And if we water all the time, it just kind of keeps its roots up by the surface. And then it's also more prone to getting some of these root rot diseases that, you know, will affect how long it lives and how much it produces. And, you know, we're in this one for the long haul, you know, 15 years or what you're thinking about. You got to be thinking 15 years rather than I'm growing a tomato crop this year and next year I'm going to start a new tomato crop. And so it's a little bit different way of thinking about things.
And you also, again, like you said, have to think ahead, because what you do the year before, how you manage it, is going to affect how you get the harvest.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's the big issue with perennial plants. You know, whether we're talking about fruit trees or whether we're talking about our grape plants or whether we're talking about asparagus, you know, in many ways, what you do this year is going to have some impact and some influence on what's going to happen next year. So if we see apples going into alternate bearing, it has a lot to do with, you know, maybe excessively heavy fruit loads. We haven't thinned them adequately. And so oftentimes people do that. They just, you know, they don't really know how to manage the plant. And so they just kind of say, well, you know, it takes care of itself, right? And then it doesn't flower. I have a crab apple that does that. Here's a classic example. And last year it bloomed like mad and it set fruit like crazy. Well, it didn't bloom very heavy this year. And so it's kind of into this alternative mode. Well, am I unhappy that that crab apple does that? Not necessarily, because it's kind of can create a mess for you if you have a lot of fruit. And you know, people know how messy that can be. But we don't like to see that happening. And so asparagus is very similar. And so, you know, we have to now be thinking about it. So what else should we do with our asparagus besides that heavy irrigation?
Do you need to feed it
at all? Need to give it some fertilizer. You know, if we're trying to be somewhat organic, you know, get some well-rotted compost and lay that over top of the bed. And then, you know, as you're irrigating, the nutrients that are from that will be leaching into the root zone where the plant can acquire it. If you're into using fertilizers, generally at this time of the year, we'd say you don't need any extra phosphorus or any extra potassium, but you do need some extra nitrogen, because what you're trying to do is grow quite a bit of fern and help that fern be vigorous. So, you know, maybe the equivalent of a cup per 10 linear feet of bed if you're using something like ammonium sulfate, and maybe half a cup if you're using something like urea, because ammonium sulfate has less nitrogen in it than urea does.
So once you get the bed established, do you need to give it much of anything else other than the nitrogen to get it?
No, mostly most of the time it's just the fertilizer nitrogen that we need, because
you can't get the phosphorus down
to
the roots.
Yeah,
so.
And you can't get it down. But the other thing is that, you know, we've done some work and people have looked at what the nutrient capacity of the plant is. And so essentially we collect root samples and then we analyze what the nutrient content is in those root samples. And then you need to also kind of know how big the root system is. And when we do those calculations, what we basically see is that the plant is a really effective recycler of things like phosphorus and potassium and the trace minerals. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of them stored in the root system itself and in the crown. And so adding extra P and extra K really doesn't show any response. And I was working with some of my colleagues in England, and they were running a trial where they were adding all kinds of levels of phosphorus and potash to an established asparagus planting and could see no yield response. But they didn't have any idea how big the root system was. And so I did some calculations for them, and then I showed them why that wasn't having any impact. And so then, but when we looked at nitrogen, the nitrogen levels go up and down quite dramatically, and so there is a response to the nitrogen. So normally the farmers will then come back in after the harvest, spread some fertilizer on there, irrigate it into the soil. Yeah, and that's all you really need after harvest. So we are applying ours. You know, we do it with the irrigation. We just inject it into the irrigation water, and that will help with the vigor of that fern, ensure that it's, you know, most active, it's producing lots of energy that's going to be stored, and then that's going to keep our productivity up for next year.
Does it need to be a quick-release nitrogen, or can you use an extended
release? You can use
an
extended release, and that's why, you know, some of our organic people, you know, a lot of compost over the top of the bed, or, you know, maybe taking some fish emulsion or something like that, and soaking that into the bed, and then using the irrigation to move it down where the roots can get it. You know, whatever your fertilizer source is, you kind of need to get it down into the soil. So normally we recommend put it on and then water it in.
Okay. Well, lest you think this is an asparagus-only program, although I don't see anything bad about that, call with your questions or comment. It's 1-800-826-1495. Dan Drost, USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, is my guest, and you can join us at 800-826-1495, or email us your question, zestygarden@gmail.com. We do have our first question. It's from Jake in Hiram. It says, my wife enjoys making pies, breads, cake, and other treats, combining rhubarb with a variety of fruits from what can only be termed a rhubarb hedge. What's the best way to divide the root without killing the plant?
Well, normally what we would say is, you know, after, you know, next spring, you kind of want to go in this fall. It as the heat comes on and the rhubarb starts to go dormant during the summer, you want to go in and just look at that crown carefully. What you end up noticing with rhubarb is that it has several different directions of growth that are there. And you kind of go in and maybe flag it, and then next spring go in and essentially take a square nose shovel with a sharp edge to it and cut right through the middle of that crown. And essentially what I recommend is that you actually dig out a whole plant and then divide it up from there and start a new planting from the divisions that come from that one plant that you're removing.
So it takes a splitting pretty well, perennial flower.
Yeah, it is extremely hardy. You know, he's not going to be able to kill it. So essentially saying, I've got four or five rhubarb plants that I use for this, go in about every year and split one. And we find that if we divide them about every fifth year, then what we have is maintain the vigor of that plant, because that plant gets bigger and bigger and it starts to crowd in on itself, and then the stalk diameter of the rhubarb gets thinner and thinner. Now, and so you like those big fleshy ones, so dividing it on about a 5-year cycle tends to be the best way to maintain the vigor of it. So the problem comes is that, you know, if you take one plant and you divide it into five pieces, it doesn't take too many years before you have a ton of rhubarb growing around. So, you know, find somebody else
share
that
it.
Wants share all those divisions, because it's like any perennial plant. You know, we do need to divide them to maintain vigor. And often when we divide them, we can, you know, kind of quickly overwhelm ourselves with the total amount of material that we have. And so we can tend to do that. About every year we divide one plant, you know, throw most of it away, save the most vigorous piece, replant it, and that way we maintain our planting and we maintain the vigor in it, and that also maintains the stalk size in it. Now, we would do that in the spring. We'd grow it all next year without harvesting anything off of that. And then the next year, in the second year after we've done that, we maybe take a small harvest off of that and allow it to grow. And then after that, we can take, you know, up to a half or three quarters of the stems we can pull off of the plant and use for our pies and cakes and whatever else we're going to do with it.
Now, is there any difference between a green-stemmed rhubarb and those that are either light red or darker red or bright red?
Well, how do you mean, in terms of
flavor? Yes.
I don't know that I've ever done a study.
Are the red ones more sweet or something?
No, I think not necessarily. Flavor has a lot to do with, you know, the vigor, a lot to do with how we've been managing it. certainly we know that if we water stress it or something like that, that causes more stringiness in the petiole, and that's what we're eating. And in terms of sweetness or sourness, I think there are varietal differences that are there. I don't really know what the variety is that I have because someone gave me some divisions and I planted them out at the farm. And the reason I planted them out at the research farm was I take my students out there in the fall when I teach our vegetable class and, you know, talk to them about crop management. And we talk about it in class, but sometimes they need to see it as well. And so we can look at the crown. We can talk about how we would divide this up. And in our extension publication on rhubarb, we have that kind of information there. So on the website, if you go to the Utah State University website and then into the extension site and then just put in the search engines that are there on that web page, rhubarb, you'll come up with the publication, and it tells you a lot about how to do that.
Well, and I also suppose that if you tend to like things a little bit more sour, what's going to taste great to you may not taste great to somebody
else. Yeah, so. And it sounds like he's putting other things in it. And, you know, I know when Dawn makes pies and sauce and those kinds of things with the rhubarb, you know, we tend to be one that we were raised with that little more sourness. So, yeah, some sugar gets put in it, but we never really put the full amount of sugar that maybe a recipe might have. We always start out with half the amount simply because oftentimes then it's just way too sweet, and it's overpowering with the sugar that you're having rather than getting those rhubarb flavors. And I'm much more interested in the rhubarb flavors, a little bit of tartness that's there.
Well, we have another email question. This is from Carla in St. George, and it's going back to asparagus. She says, "Oh, no, I just planted asparagus crowns in two containers this year. It has come up and is tiny and ferning. Yep. I'm happy to know that July and August are the bud-setting periods, but now I'm worried about long-term success. Does container-grown asparagus work in the long term? The containers I'm using now are the long, flat, rectangular ones. Is this not going to work?"
Long, flat, rectangular container. Well, she may have to email us. Listen and email us some more because rhubarb is all about growing.
Oh, this is asparagus.
Yeah. I mean, asparagus is all about a big root. And so, you know, you want that to get down deep into the soil.
And we're talking about earlier how deep the root
gets. Yeah, 3 or 4 feet. And so I did some research where we were growing plants in 15-gallon pots, and it took about 14 months before the plant was pushing its way out of that pot. So, I mean, the root system grows really, really fast the first couple years, and it wants to go deep, and it wants to spread out wide. And so, generally, container asparagus does not work very well. It would be better to find a good site in the vegetable garden where you put those plants and, you know, double dig the site so that you can allow those roots to really go deeply in the soil. And I think she would be much, much better off if she did that.
And what about in St. George? I usually think of asparagus as being a cooler weather crop. But.
Yeah, you're right. It is. But, you know, there are a large number of asparagus growers in the Imperial Valley of Southern California. And if you know where the Imperial Valley of Southern California, Riverside and south all the way to the border, and then a lot of asparagus that's into Mexico that's in that northern region. It's very hot. There's a tremendous amount of asparagus grown in and around Yuma. It's a lot hotter in Yuma than it is in St. George. The key thing with it under those hot conditions is, you know, water management. And these guys apply a lot of water to the crop, but they're growing it because they want early asparagus. And there's a huge market for asparagus in and around the Christmas period and in through early January. And that's the market that they're tapping into. So, yeah, it can be done in containers, but it's not very long lived in containers because the plant just grows so fast that it kind of overtakes the structure. Now, if it's a raised bed and it has access to the soil that's below that raised bed, you know, then that's a different issue. But if it's just kind of in a pot, you know, it has to be in a really, really big pot. When I did my sabbatic work in Germany, I was working with the scientists over there, and he had Containers that were a yard by a yard by a yard. So a cubic yard of soil is kind of the minimum amount of space that you need. And then he found that he could grow those plants in there for about 4 years before they really had to remove them and start over, because the rooting mass was so great that they felt that it was impacting their research. So in the field, that's kind of the number that we work with, that about a cubic yard of soil is, you know, kind of necessary to grow this plant. And if your container is that big, great. I don't think her containers are that big. So
probably
she may want to, you know, reconsider how she's
growing
these.
As long as they're tiny right now, she can wait till next spring and then transplant them?
She could wait till next spring. And do it almost any time. She could do it now.
Okay.
It's just a matter of, you know, getting that site prepped and then being able to keep them from being too stressed with the heat that's coming on in St. George. And so that just means a little extra water and that kind of stuff. And generally, if you're looking at the Imperial Valley of California, they may irrigate every 10 days with a heavy irrigation rather than our every 3 weeks with a heavy irrigation, or depending on your soil, if it's a heavier soil, maybe every 4 weeks.
And there just happens to be a great USU Extension publication on growing asparagus.
Always is a great Extension publication.
Go to gardens.usu.edu and just do a search for
asparagus.
At that site for asparagus, yeah. And you're going to get a publication that tells you exactly how to plant, how to amend the soil, you know, putting phosphorus in there, how much.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
I used it.
Good.
We have another question. If you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. This one is coming from Catherine. She says, how do I get my strawberry plants to produce larger berries? I think they are seascape berries. The plants are about 2 years old. You want to take a berry question?
Yeah, I can handle that. We're doing work on strawberries. And, you know, we found that this year, for whatever reason, our berry size is down a little bit. We aren't really certain about what's going on. Seascape is a ever-bearer. As the temperature increases, there's an optimum temperature for strawberries and strawberry production. Generally, when the temperatures start getting above 75 during the day and 65 at night, and I think we've been hitting those kind of numbers because it was fairly warm the last few nights, and then we see a great reduction in berry size. And that just happens to be because the plants themselves are kind of programmed to function at much cooler temperatures. And so as the season kind of progresses, berry size is going to get smaller, particularly with these ever-bearers. They should continue to flower during the summer, but, you know, the size is just going to get progressively smaller because we're moving into hotter and hotter conditions. So how do we solve that problem? I don't know that you can, because I can't really regulate heat that much. You know, some people have tried shading. We're growing berries in tunnels, so we've put up our shade cloth to try and reduce the temperature slightly in there, and that helps a lot. But you also need to have sufficient light down to the plant, because, you know, it's that photosynthetic energy that the leaf is producing that goes into the berry that helps with berry flavor and that. So make sure that they're well hydrated. Continue to feed them. The plants require quite a bit of fertilizer, surprisingly, as they're putting energy into growing these berries. And oftentimes, if we're starving them a little bit with nutrients, if we're underwatering them a little bit, berry size is going to go down. Now, another issue that we've seen this year that's been, and I'm not certain why it is, but we've got a lot more spider mites on our strawberries. I have some plants at home myself, and I was looking at them the other day, and I said to myself, boy, you know, they're just kind of getting a little bit more yellow. You know, I've been feeding them and watering them well, and then I started looking closer at the plants, and I go, oh, man, they're full of mites. And so I'm just going to rip mine out, because I tend to plant new plants in the fall, and I kind of use them as a one-year type of crop. And so they're going out and something else is going back in, and I just have to decide what I'm going to put in there.
Because that's another thing, that the growers in California, for instance, are replanting fairly often, and that's part of how they get those fantastically large berries.
Yeah, but she should be okay because she said this is only her second year, and normally we start seeing berry size decreases that occur starting the third or the fourth year, and that has a lot to do with crowding. And in the home garden, we're often apprehensive to kind of rogue out the plants the way we need to, you know, to make the rows narrow enough to give them enough space to grow. We kind of let the daughter plants take over, and then we maintain the mother plant as well because we just think she's going to be able to produce some. We think we're going to get more berries out of it, when in fact, if we're a little bit more aggressive in our roguing, you know, once the daughter plants kind of establish themselves, rogue out those older plants. Those older plants have done their job. They're not really that productive anymore. We find that maintains the vigor in the field and in the berry patch, and as a result, we get more, you know, berries out of it.
So those daughter plants, even though they are newer plants, they're genetically identical to the mother.
Yep.
Are they considered as old as the mother?
Well, no, because, you know, the runners get pushed out based on environmental conditions as well. So as, you know, if it's warm and longer days, they tend to put out runners. And so you'll start seeing a lot more runnering that goes on now. Well, you know, get those established and then come back in and till out those areas that have the. And so people tend to rotate the kind of rows, and you have an in-row area that you put the daughter plants in, and then you rogue out the mother plants.
Well, so do you have, I'm just guessing then, that those act just like new plants?
Yes. I mean,
you could keep those daughter plants for 3 or 4 years?
Three or 4 years, okay. But, you know, you're going to, you know, just kind of reestablish the bed on a regular basis, and most people just aren't aggressive enough in these what we call a matted row system of growing strawberries.
Okay, well, we're going to have a quick break, and I hope that you'll join our conversation. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. He'll be with us through the hour, and I hope you'll call with your question or comment, 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. Or you can email us at zestygarden@gmail.com. During this break, we're going to hear the next segment of Take a Hike, and then we'll be back with Dan Drost. So stay tuned.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Black Pearl Asian Bistro and Sushi in North Logan, serving traditional Chinese dishes, a taste of Thai, nigiri, sushi, and sashimi. Open 7 days a week. Information at 435-750-0888.
Welcome to our second edition of Take a Hike. I have with me in studio today David Wallace. He's a hobbyist in botany and has his degree in biology.
In public health and biology.
And is an officer in the Utah Native Plant Society and a leader in the Cache Hikers. And so our next hike is actually on the foothills region. And what are we going to look at this time?
Well, this gives us a great opportunity to look at one of my favorite flowers. This is the Sega Lily. Many people in Utah, well, I hope most people in Utah know about the Sega Lily because it's our state flower, but it is not often seen. It has a fairly short blooming period in mid-June to late June around our foothills. And part of the problem with the Sega Lily is its habitat has been encroached by development, and we're seeing fewer areas where they grow. Fortunately, here in Cache Valley, we have a great place. It's the Bonneville Shoreline Trail. It's right at the elevation where the Sega Lilies grow, and it's a nice hiking trail if you want to go there as well.
Now, I've seen Sega Lilies on, it seems like, south-facing slopes, more gravelly-type slopes, so I'm assuming they like really good drainage.
Yes, they like dry, well-drained soil. They're usually found in association with sagebrush and similar plants, the forbs and grasses of the foothills. I know people have tried to collect the bulbs and grow them, but I think they're absolutely unsuccessful. My understanding is if you even water them once, they die.
Wow. So they really don't like to have any care at all. And with, I'm assuming, our soils down here being more clay and probably, I don't know, more alkaline, maybe, I don't know how much that plays into it.
I can't say so much about the alkalinity, but it's probably a factor. Certainly the drainage is. There is, for years, there's somebody in Salt Lake City who's been salvaging Siegel lily bulbs from areas that are scheduled for development and selling them at the gardeners, at the farmer's market there.
So it's not a protected species.
It's not protected, but it's something we certainly should respect. And I would say you should never pick one of these because you can kill the plant by picking the bloom of the lily, these lily family flowers.
So can you tell me the story behind the lily? Why is it the Utah state flower?
The Siegel lily has a bulb, and the Indians have been eating it as a food source for obviously decades, centuries. And there's the story is that when the pioneers came here, that was one of the native plants that they relied on to help them survive. To commemorate that, it was named as the Utah state flower.
So what does it look like?
It's one of our most attractive flowers. It has a pearly or almost a satiny white bloom about 2 to 3 inches across in a kind of a wine glass shaped cup. When it tends to open up a little bit as it gets more mature, but it looks, that's the general shape. Inside the throat, there'll be deep maroon and yellow markings. It's quite a striking plant, especially because the leaves are and the stem is almost impossible to see. It looks just like grass. In fact, it's interesting. I haven't talked about scientific names here yet, but the scientific name for the Siegel lily is Calochortus natalii. Now, nuttall is the botanist it's named for. That's where the natalii comes from. But Calochortus means in Latin beautiful grass. And so I think that's a great name. Another interesting thing about the Siegel lily, only in Utah is it called Siegel because that was the native name for the plant. Elsewhere, it's known as a Mariposa lily, which is Spanish for butterfly.
So where is its growing range?
Well, it grows, this particular species, Natalia, grows all over the state. We have some other more restricted species that grow in the south and the east, some of those are colored pink and yellow, for example.
So is this particular species, can it be seen throughout the Intermountain West?
It's through much of the Intermountain West.
Okay.
Certainly it is all throughout Utah, and I believe it's throughout most of the Intermountain West.
So it's white, and about how tall is it?
It grows about a foot tall, and like I say, it's in the dry sagebrush areas, and it's quite, when you notice it, you'll see these little light bulbs of white scattered around. Go up closer to them, and you'll get a pleasant surprise.
And will you see it by itself, or will it be growing next to something else?
It just generally grows scattered around with the other plants. I've seen it. I don't think it really has a plant that associates with.
Okay. So tell us about the trail. Where do you recommend someone to start and then end?
Okay. The trail that I'm talking about is the Bonneville Shoreline Trail. This is a popular trail. It's right close to Logan. Hikers, walkers, bicyclists, runners, joggers, everybody uses it. And it's a fairly new trail. It's just built within the last 10 years or so. The portion that is built here is from Green Canyon to Highway 89 near First Dam. There's an effort to build the Bonneville Shoreline Trail over much of northern Utah, and then I know it's going down on in the Salt Lake area as well. But here we have this section completed. In order to hike it, you could go either direction. You could start at the First Dam, which is the mouth of Logan Canyon, or you could start at the mouth of Green Canyon.
And there's a parking lot at either end.
There's a place to park at either end. At the Green Canyon site, there's a widened area that's cleared. You'll see the obvious trail signs right at the end of the canyon. There's some informative signs. There's even a place where you can grab a bag if you're accompanied by a dog. At the other end, if you choose to go that direction, you could park at the parking area near the First Dam, the park at First Dam.
Okay.
Now, the interesting thing about the First Dam parking is you can park right there next to the green area where the park is, and there's an underpass that's been built, so you can actually walk underneath Highway 89 without exposing yourself to traffic.
And I'm imagining in my mind the trail, that's probably going to be the largest elevation gain is from the Logan end, because it just kind of switchbacks up the alluvial fan of Old Lake Bonneville, and then you get to the top, and then is it fairly, not too much elevation gain the rest of the way?
Well, the trail undulates as it goes across the drainages, so you go up and down a little bit. It kind of also has to make accommodations for the power lines, which are also in that vicinity. But you're right, the steepest climb is from Highway 89 up to the Bonneville level.
So if someone didn't even want to climb very much, they could just go in from the Green Canyon end and just hike a ways in and then come back out. Otherwise, you'll have to have a shuttle, so once you get off on one end, you can come all the way back to the other end.
You can do a shuttle from one end to the other, or you can go part way and go back, or go the full way and go back. It's about 2 miles from Green Canyon to Highway 89. So a round trip would be 4 miles, or you could go part way.
And about how long will this take?
Well, it depends on how
long often you stop and look.
Yeah. If you want to make it really short, start at Green Canyon, and within a quarter mile, you'll encounter, if you have your eyes open, you'll see some of the seagull lilies along the side. They tend to be more after about a half a mile to about a mile, about 1.4, 1.3 miles down from Green Canyon. So you could only walk a half a mile or a mile and a half and turn around and go back, or extend your hike as well. It's up to you.
And what else will be seen along the hike besides views of Cache Valley?
Sure, we're talking about flowers. I noticed that I was just up there the other day, and the northern sweet vetch is out. The little sunflower, the Helianthella uniflora, is out. The mule's ear is past its peak, and but you'll still see some of the mule's ear flowers and big yellow flowers. The South Little Yarrow. Many of the other flowers are beyond their peak or gone to seed, like the foothill death camas. The balsam root.
Okay. Sounds like a great, easy hike to do, something to take the family on and maybe the dog.
It would be a great hike for that.
All right, David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And to get information about this hike, this information is posted to our website at upr.org. Just click on Programs and then go to Zesty Garden, and you'll find maps and information about this hike. David Wallace is an officer in the Utah Native Plant Society and a leader in with Cache Hikers. And he did want me to mention that when you go on this hike, you're going to see construction signs that say the trail is closed. The trail is not closed. Everybody ignores these signs, he says, because they were there for the canal reconstruction. The canal reconstruction is done. The signs just haven't been taken down. So ignore the signs.
I ignore signs anyway, so when it says to go 65, I go 55.
You go the opposite direction.
No, not really.
Well, the sago lily is a beautiful little flower, so I think this would be a great hike for the family to go on. All right, so let's launch in, Dan, to some of the heat stress issues that might be popping up. How can you tell if your vegetable garden is having heat stress?
Well, a couple of the different crops that we do grow that we planted early, things like spinach or lettuce, our parsley, our peas, all of those kind of crops are what we classify as cool weather crops. And so as we start moving into this hotter time of the year, we start to see those plants come under some stress. And they come under heat stress, and two things can happen. One, you get a decrease in growth that occurs, so that the plant vigor isn't there anymore. If you've been having leaf lettuce and harvesting copious quantities of that for salads when the weather was much cooler, and now they just don't seem to be coming back and bouncing back from a harvest, that's usually a sign that the plant is under some heat stress. The other thing that we tend to see in some of those crops, particularly like lettuce, we get more of these milky sap type compounds that are being formed. They get in the leaf that creates
bitter.
More of a bitter flavor. Yeah, so that's a heat related thing. With crops like peas, what we might find is that pod set is somewhat reduced. Some of us, if we weren't quick enough in getting our peas in early enough, they're going to be flowering about now. And you know, this heat is really hard on fruit set when it comes to those crops like pea and stuff that we want that pod to form and we want it to grow vigorously. And so how do we solve that problem? Well, some people put some shade out, you know, try to grow them in on the side of a plant that would cast shade on them. So that's a one way to do it, or put it in more of that shady section in your vegetable garden. The other thing is, you know, just to make sure that our irrigation is timely and appropriate, trying to ensure that that plant isn't water stressed as well as heat stressed. You know, if the plant is well hydrated, it can oftentimes take care of itself a lot better and deal with those heat related issues. And so that's a kind of a common occurrence that happens at this time of the year. But heat will affect our warm season vegetable crops as well. You know, that's why we often recommend with tomato and pepper and things like that, as the soil starts to heat up more, as more sun gets down to it, that we look at mulching in and around it. You know, put, you know, some wood chips down there, put some, you know, grass clippings in and around that, some
so help
straw.
Them have cool feet.
It helps the soil maintain a lower temperature, and therefore the plant can get water that much easier out of it, and it doesn't just, you know, put both the root system and the tops under stress. Now, this year, what I've done is I've had a bit of a struggle over the last few years trying to get my basil to grow. And I make lots of pesto because I like to use it both in the year and freeze some for the winter. And I've decided this year I was going to go all pots. I was going to put everything in a pot. And I have had the most unbelievable amount of growth, because there's a plant that actually likes the roots being warmer. And I think I just, with the cooler water that was coming and being put on that soil, it just wasn't getting enough heat into the soil, and so the plants weren't very vigorous. And it didn't seem like it was until August that I was kind of really getting, you know, a lot of growth out of my basil. But this year, boy, I transplanted it, and golly, it's just going so fast, and so I've got a lot of it in pots. I did put some in the soil as well, and we were looking at the pots and the plants last night as we were, you know, we often do. We kind of wander the yard as the sun's starting to lower itself, and, you know, the heat of the day is gone. And
the,
you
king
know,
surveying his
yes,
kingdom.
Yes, like that, you know, and he wandered in the garden in the cool of the evening. You know, there is some poetry that goes with that. And with his fair maiden. and you know, it was just, I couldn't believe it. And Dawn says, oh, the basil smells so nice, you know, because you get that, you know, those aromatics that come off of it. And so we were comparing what was in the soil to what was in the pots. And the ones in the pots, which were planted transplanted from the same series of plants at the same time, were nearly twice as big in the pots.
Wow.
And so I've just kind of, you know, my neighbor always, Carol Rosenthal, who many people may know. She used to help, I think, once in a while at NPR. But Carol always did hers in pots. And I just finally decided, okay, enough of this. I'll have less flowers and I'll have more basil. And I'm really happy with it. But there's something that likes warm roots. Now, not all plants like warm roots. And so particularly our fruiting crops, things like tomato and pepper and eggplant and things like that, will do a whole lot better if we can just start to mulch in and around those plants. And, you know, oftentimes when we use grass clippings as mulch, one of the worst things that we can do is to kind of put that green, wet material in and around the plants. It's actually almost better to try and dry it out and make a hay out of it rather than use that fresh mass there.
So it doesn't compact?
It doesn't compact as much. It doesn't start to rot. It doesn't allow some of these secondary organisms to get up close to the plant. And so that's why straw is really a good a type of mulch to use in your vegetable garden.
Plus it holds moisture. I mean,
it helps to hold moisture. It creates a nice barrier there, and it doesn't smell and do some of those things. So if you have a way to kind of dry it out a little bit before you start using it, it's sometimes better. Or just spread it out a little thinner. And, you know, we mow often enough that, you know, it doesn't take very long for, you to get a lot of grass together, but people tend to pile it up too deep, and then it starts to kind of compost itself in place, and then the plants don't really like that either. So, you know, be a little careful with doing that, and then just watch your irrigation. You know, you need to really, as these days get a lot hotter, you know, we need to apply water, not necessarily more often, but we need to put larger volumes on, because what you're really trying to do is fill the profile and encourage the roots to grow deeply into the soil, and then that helps buffer their ability to be able to extract them the water that they need to ensure that they aren't under stress. And then it also helps them to gather the nutrients that they need so that they can maintain their vigor and they continue to grow and things like that.
So I guess here's the key of another reason why is planting as early as you can, that the plant will allow you to grow so you can get leaf coverage.
That's right.
That helps shade the
size is real important. And, you know, a lot of people have said over the summers, I talk to lots of gardeners and they say, oh, you know, I just have a lot of fruit that have, you know, sunburn injury on them, or we have more blossom end rot in them. And all those things are water-related problems due to a plant that's under stress, and oftentimes the plant really isn't large enough to support the fruits that are there. And so getting them out quick enough at the right time so that they grow fast and create some leaf area so that when the fruits do get set, they have some protection from the heat of the sun due to the shading that they're getting just from the leaves that the plant holds.
Okay, so in the next 90 seconds, what can still be planted?
Well, I think some of the things that we can get onto is, you know, if you're going to grow some transplants for, you know, summer cabbage, for fall production, for fall broccoli, those types of things, you want to get your seeds started here soon. And we can do that indoors. There's enough light and that kind of stuff to grow those transplants. Often within the next 3 or 4 weeks, you know, the nurseries and garden centers are going to clean out most of their vegetable crops. Sweet corn, of course, you know, we can still get some plantings of that, but, you know, we want to stay with some of the shorter maturity types. So, you know, if you get above a 75-day maturity class, you know, that means it's going to, in Logan here anyway, you know, we're going to be way into September and it may not mature off. If you're in Salt Lake or someplace like that, it will. If you're maybe down in Cedar, it might. Certainly in some of our warmer areas, we can plant some of the longer maturity types. And so get those transplants started and, you know, think about, you know, continually seeding some fall sweet corn so that you have enough for the year.
Well, Dan, thank you very much for coming in.
Why does it always go so fast?
It always does. You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. In our garden calendar, the Stokes Nature Center is having a backyard harvest program. It's integrated pest management with USU IPM project manager Marion Murray. It's Wednesday, June 19th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at a private residence. Register at nature@logannature.org. There is a phone number at 755-3239. Then there's an urban garden and farm tour. The Wasatch Community Gardens in Salt Lake City is having this. It is on June 22nd. It begins at 9 a.m. at Squatters Pub at 147 West Broadway from 9 to 11. And you can, if you have any questions, just go to wasatchgardens.org. And then the Tahnequint Nature Center in St. George is having a workshop called Slow Spread and Sink River Friendly Landscapes. Connect your front yard and watershed slow spread and spring rainwater by creating sponge gardens, sustainably, aesthetically appealing landscapes. It's a workshop by calling 673-3617. And then there's a vegetable garden insect and disease management workshop with Iron County Visitor Center. It's Friday, June 21st from 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. And you need to register by calling 586-8132. And then there's a WaterWise plant selection and garden tour in Iron County from 6 to 8 p.m. on June the 13th. This what is today? Today's the 13th. Yeah. So it's today from 6 to 8 p.m. Learn how to properly select and care for your landscape plants. Cost is free. Participants must register by calling 435-586-8132. Thanks for joining us on the Zesty Garden.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.